From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Kurds barely holding on to a border town. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, the ups and downs of the Hong Kong pro-democracy movement, and what about the leader of North Korea? Where is he? Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The United States and Saudi Arabia launched more airstrikes Monday on Islamic State targets near Kobani, Syria, as Kurdish fighters and the insurgents engaged in fierce fighting for control of that town. The U.S. military command said American and Saudi fighter jets carried out four sorties southwest of Kobani, hitting Islamic State units, damaging a staging location, and destroying a heavy machine gun position. Three other airstrikes hit Islamic State targets northeast of the town of Kobani, including two buildings controlled by the jihadists. In the Turkish villages along the border, local Kurds and refugees from the Islamic State onslaught are also maintaining a vigil observing the month-long battle. It's a mixture of hope and dread all at the same time, with news that the jihadists are pouring in reinforcements. Their fears are mounting that Kobani will fall. Jamie Detmer has more from the border between Syria and Turkey.
The stiff defense of Kobani in the face of a month-long assault by Islamic militants is a source of great pride for Kurds on both sides of the Syrian-Turkish border. And refugees from the mainly Kurdish-Syrian town, along with Turkish Kurds watching the battle, still cling to the hope that the outnumbered and outgunned defenders can hold on. But news that the Islamic State, also known as ISIL, is pouring reinforcements into the embattled town is prompting alarm. Ali, a 47-year-old shepherd from a Turkish village near here, says his 18-year-old daughter, Evan, is fighting in Kobani with the Kurdish Defense Force, the YPG. She says in her latest cell phone call to him from inside the virtually encircled city, she lamented the mismatch between the opposing sides in the numbers of fighters, saying that she does not know where all the jihadists come from. She complained about the Turkish government's refusal to allow a corridor between the border and Kobani so Kurdish volunteers from Turkey and Syria could join the fight. If there were equal numbers, Evan argued, the Kurds would beat the Islamic State and hold Kobani. Western and UN officials have echoed the sentiments of the 18-year-old Kurdish girl who slipped over the border into Syria to join the YPG 6 months ago to fight without telling her parents of her plans. But the Turkish government is refusing to allow Kurdish reinforcements in to relieve the flagging defenders, prompting Kurds to accuse Ankara of being in a secret partnership with the Islamic State, or at least seeing the Kurds as a greater danger than the Islamic militants. Turkey has battled a self-ruled insurgency for 30 years, mounted by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, and the YPG is an offshoot of the PKK. There is now a faltering peace process with Turkish Kurds, but PKK activists say if Kobani falls, then the peace process will be finished. Violent Kurdish protests during the past several days in towns across Turkey have left nearly 40 dead, and the government is braced for more problems, with soldiers deployed for the first time in years again in Kurdish towns. Abu Bakr Omar Abdullah, a member of the Iraqi Kurdistan Parliament, who visited briefly in Kobani a few days ago, says the situation is dire, and the defenders have small arms, while Islamic State militants are equipped with larger weaponry, including tanks. He says the defenders remain determined. He says the fighting is merciless, and much of it now is street by street and house by house. The Kurds are only holding about a third of the town, mainly in a north-central area, and YPG sources say there is just a narrow exit to Turkey. US-led coalition airstrikes on the jihadists in Kobani have helped the Kurds to hold out, but American officials say it is only a matter of time before Kobani falls. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Surak.
Islamic State militants have tightened their grip on Iraq's Anbar province, capturing a training camp in Heat, which is north of the provincial capital Ramadi. Arab media outlets are also reporting that government forces have evacuated several positions inside Ramadi, including two prisons. Edward Uranian reports from the VOA Middle East Bureau.
Iraqi government forces continued to give ground to Islamic State militants Monday around Anbar's provincial capital, Ramadi, amid worries the militants might gain control of the entire province. Iraqi troops withdrew from a training base in Heat, 7 kilometers northwest of the provincial capital, Ramadi, but continue to hold the larger Ain al-Assad base. Al Arabiya TV reported that Iraqi security forces also withdrew from Ramadi's central prison, as well as the smaller Khalidiyah prison. It said the prisoners were taken to other facilities in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. The government garrison at Haditha, which controls Iraq's second largest dam, is also reportedly encircled by the militants. Anbar province governor Sabah al-Kharhout told Iraq's Asharqiya TV the government must send reinforcements to Ramadi and intensify airstrikes in order to prevent the provincial capital from falling. He says discussions are taking place with the U.S. and international coalition over what can be done, and Anbar is asking the Iraqi central government for a brigade and air cover to prevent the fall of the whole province. He says the Islamic State controls 70% to 75% of Anbar, and its fall would lead to the fall of Baghdad, Karbala, and Babel province. The Anbar Provincial Council issued an appeal to the U.S. and coalition forces to send ground troops and Apache helicopters to help defend remaining government positions against attack by Islamic State militants. Council member Taha Abdul Ghani explains why. He says that U.S. ground troops and Apache helicopters would bolster the tribal fighters against Islamic State terrorists and would help them to hold remaining positions in Anbar province and potentially retake lost territory. Arab media reported clashes between Iraqi security forces and Islamic State militants in the Baghdad suburb of Abu Ghraib. U.S. Joint Chiefs Chairman John Dempsey indicated Sunday the United States had used Apache helicopters to prevent an Iraqi unit in Abu Ghraib from falling. But an Iraqi military commander in Abu Ghraib insisted his forces continue to control the center of Abu Ghraib, including the hospital and market, and that all was quiet. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond met in Baghdad with Iraqi Foreign Minister Ibrahim Jaafari, saying the British government would help arm Iraqi government forces.
We have said to the Iraqi government that we will ensure that the support we provide is balanced between the Kurdish security forces and the Iraqi security forces. We're clear that we want to support both parts of this campaign against ISIL.
Hammond insisted that to beat ISIL, it is the Iraqi people, the Iraqi security forces, and the Iraqi government that will have to take the lead on the ground. Iraqi TV reported President Fuad Mahsoum met with Vice President Osama Nujafi to discuss the implementation of a plan to set up a National Guard for Sunni regions of the country. Sunni leaders have long complained the government has based mostly Shiite military units in Sunni regions, exacerbating sectarian tensions. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With the landing of
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
As Liberia tries to end a months-long Ebola crisis, local and international media right groups report an intensifying crackdown on journalists in the country. But journalists say this is only a continuation of Liberia's bad record on press freedom, which taints the West's positive image of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Benno Mushler reports.
7 months into the worst Ebola outbreak ever, several media rights groups accused the Liberian government of preventing journalists from reporting the magnitude of the crisis. Last week, Liberia's Deputy Minister of Information said on the radio that his government will prevent journalists from entering Ebola treatment units in order to protect the privacy of the patients. Critics see this as an attempt to hide facts about the ongoing outbreak that has killed more than 2,300 Liberians and damaged the national economy. On October 8th, the World Health Organization said the reported fall in the number of new cases in Liberia over the past 3 weeks is unlikely to be genuine and rather reflects a lack of capacity in data gathering. Liberia's Minister of Information, Louis Brown, says the allegations of government interference in Ebola news coverage are not true and adds that the government has always put an emphasis on strengthening press freedom.
Even though we are in a state of emergency, we have not permitted ourselves to slip into a situation where we were denied free speech and freedom of information. We have not and will not. We fought too hard, including the president. The president is a champion for rights and freedom. All her life, she's fought for it.
Media rights groups have a different view. Abdoulaye Camara, who is the president of the Press Union of Liberia, says the government has tried to restrict the media on several occasions during the Ebola crisis.
There's a case involving the Women Voices newspaper, and the paper actually wrote about corruption within the police in respect to Ebola-related activities. And the publisher was invited to the police station and virtually harassed.
The Committee to Protect Journalists, an international media watchdog, says another newspaper, the National Chronicle, was raided by police, citing urgent national security concerns as justification for their actions. National Chronicle publisher Philibert Brown was present during the raid.
During the interim, the police had thrown tear gas into our office, so we fled from the front of the office to the back where we had the ventilation to breathe. In about 5 minutes after they threw the tear gas, we started hearing the bang, bang, the heavy sound of them breaking down the office door.
The incident took place after the National Chronicle had run a story about the plans of a group of Liberians to form a new government. But publisher Brown believes the closure of his newspaper came after the coverage of massive corruption cases, including the son of President Johnson Sirleaf.
It's so disappointing that a woman of that stature, you know, just you wouldn't even believe it. Every day you read the newspaper, from beginning to end, it's about corruption. She does nothing about it, all right? She does nothing to reprimand every time she comes out and she appoints a panel to investigate corruption. It ends with the panel.
The National Chronicle remains shut down while the case is being tried at Liberia's Supreme Court. Liberia is ranked 89th out of 180 countries in the Reporters Without Borders 2014 Press Freedom Index. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Monrovia.
America's top disease control official says the first known transmission of Ebola in the United States dictates a rethinking and a redoubling of protocols to protect healthcare workers and the public from the deadly virus. A nurse in Dallas, Texas, has tested positive for Ebola after caring for Liberian Thomas Eric Duncan, who died last week. VOA's Michael Bowman reports.
Concern about the new Ebola case extended to the White House, where President Obama invited cameras into a hastily arranged briefing on improving the U.S. health system's preparedness. Earlier, hazardous materials workers cleaned out the apartment of the infected Dallas nurse, who is now identified by family members as 26-year-old Nina Pham. The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Thomas Frieden, addressed an increasingly alarmed American public.
Stopping Ebola is hard. We have to rethink the way we address Ebola infection control, because even a single infection is unacceptable.
Precisely how the nurse became infected is unknown, whether through human error or a failure of protective gear or hospital protocols. Frieden said he cannot rule out the possibility of additional cases being detected and announced an extensive urgent campaign to alert and safeguard the nation's medical staff in hopes of preventing further transmission of Ebola.
People on the front lines are really protecting all of us. The enemy here is a virus, Ebola. It's not a person, it's not a country, it's not a place, it's not a hospital, it's a virus. It's a virus that's tough to fight, but together I'm confident that we will stop it.
Several U.S. airports are strengthening health screening procedures for passengers arriving from three West African nations. That may not be enough, according to Republican Congressman Michael McCaul, who does not rule out temporarily halting U.S. visas granted in parts of Africa.
And the American people are rightfully concerned. They are concerned because the Ebola virus is an unseen threat, and it is only a plane flight away from our shores.
Mounting fears extend beyond countries that have registered Ebola cases. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is a global epidemic. We are cooperating with other countries in addition to preserving our borders.
But panic is unwarranted and unhelpful, according to Dr. Ian Smith of the World Health Organization.
Fear of infection has spread around the world much faster than the virus.
Amid mounting anxieties, some possible good news. Russian health officials say they have developed vaccines against Ebola that are ready for testing. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Hong Kong's pro-democracy protesters rallied for peace Monday night and were on high alert after police and people suspected to have connections with the Triad Asian crime gangs removed roadblocks during the day. At a rally in front of the government headquarters, attended by a few hundred people, the demonstrators raised up their arms in a gesture of peace. John Kim Mon, the co-founder of Occupy Central, said he was touched by the young protesters' peaceful response to who he called the mobsters. On a blocked main road a few minutes' walk away from the government headquarters, demonstrators began reinforcing their existing roadblocks with new tools. One student, Anthony Fung, who helped to construct the new line of defense, said they wanted to ensure that they could protect the occupied sites.
In today's afternoon, it's hard by the government. Some people just try to destroy a roadblock inside campus. And so after school or work, we come here to build a roadblock to prevent this happening again.
Hong Kong's embattled leader Leung Chun-ying vowed on Sunday to remain in office and warned students demanding his resignation that their pro-democracy movement was out of control. Leung has warned that there was zero chance that China's leaders in Beijing would change an August decision limiting democracy in Hong Kong. Former British colony was promised what its freedoms would be, protected under a one-country, two-systems formula when Britain handed its old colony back to China 17 years ago. Beijing has said the only candidate screened by a nomination committee will be able to contest a full citywide vote to choose the new next chief executive in 2017. The U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice says the Obama administration has seen no definitive sign of a transfer of power in North Korea, where state media have been mostly mute on the whereabouts of leader Kim Jong-un, who Yonhap has just been reporting made an appearance today. VOA's Victor Beatty reports some analysts say Mr. Kim's absence for about a month now may have been the latest attempt to gain attention as the global community is distracted by other world events.
Appearing Sunday on the NBC program Meet the Press, Rice was asked if she believes Kim Jong-un remains the leader of North Korea.
Obviously, we're watching very carefully what's happening in North Korea. It's a country that we monitor with great attention. We have not seen any indications of a transfer of power at this point in North Korea that we view as definitive, but we'll continue to watch it carefully.
Last week, a U.S. State Department spokeswoman had little to say about Mr. Kim's absence other than to say she was aware of the reports, adding there is little reliable information provided by what she called the opaque North Korean regime. Mr. Kim, believed to be in his early 30s, has not been seen publicly since September 3rd and was absent during an event Friday commemorating the founding of the ruling North Korean Workers' Party. State media have said the North Korean leader is experiencing discomfort. Korea Society Vice President Stephen Norper says he does not view the absence as very significant.
Kim Jong-un himself has had two extended periods of absence before this, and this is actually something that his father and his grandfather also did, which was to not appear in press or media for a period of time. So there's an element of keep them guessing.
Norper is quick to add that something may have happened to Mr. Kim, although he says analysts who watch North Korea closely have little insight into whether Mr. Kim is the target of a power struggle, is ill, or is simply seeking international attention that is distracted by events in the Middle East and Ukraine. The South Korean news agency Yonhap quotes former U.S. Embassy Deputy Chief of Mission Mark Tokola as saying North Korean leaders have a history of wanting to receive international attention, and Mr. Kim's absence may be a non-provocative way to get it. Tokola says he believes Mr. Kim is still very much in charge. The Washington Post reports the absence comes at a time of North Korean diplomatic activity involving extensive travel by the foreign minister who addressed the U.N. General Assembly last month, the first time a North Korean diplomat has done so in 15 years. The country's international affairs secretary has also recently returned from Europe and met Mongolia's president in Beijing. North Korea has also engaged in talks with Japan over the abduction of Japanese citizens, and two top officials visited Seoul October 4 to attend the closing ceremonies of the Asian Games. Bruce Bennett of the RAND Corporation suggests the recent diplomatic flurry is a sign of a troubled economy and society in the North.
And so I think they're reaching out all sorts of places to see what help they can get. Of course, they're not willing to offer very much in return for that help. But I think they're trying to grab for straws at this point in time, going out to a variety of places. I mean, even coming to Seoul, that was such a surprise last weekend. They came, and what were they prepared to negotiate? They were prepared to negotiate, to come back and negotiate again. That's not a whole lot to be offering.
Yet the North appears unwilling to talk to the United States. The Washington Post quotes a senior Obama administration official as saying the North is trying to gain acceptance as a normal nation on the world stage and to keep their nuclear weapons program in the process. Evans Revere, a former U.S. negotiator with Pyongyang and currently a senior fellow at the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies, says the North may be resorting to a familiar pattern, a charm offensive followed by an agreement, then a break in the dialogue, collapse of the agreement followed by rising tensions. Last week, the two Koreas traded small arms fire after Pyongyang shot at a propaganda-filled balloon sent by South Korean activists. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
France's Jean Triol has been awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his research on market power and regulation. Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences announced the $1.1 million prize on Monday. For about 30 years, Triol has researched market failures and the role of a small number of large firms or a single monopoly dominating many industries. 61-year-old economist works at the Toulouse School of Economics in France. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers, Zarat Abuzaid and Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On October 14th, 1066, the Norman forces of William the Conqueror at the Battle of Hastings defeated English King Harold II and his army. Harold was killed and William claimed the throne of England, ending Anglo-Saxon rule and beginning an era of greater English involvement in continental Europe. In 1322, Robert the Bruce of Scotland defeated King Edward II of England at Byland, forcing Edward to accept Scotland's independence. On this date in 1644, William Penn, founder of the British North American colony of Pennsylvania, or Penn's Woods, was born. On this date in 1947, Air Force test pilot Captain Chuck Yeager flew the experimental Bell X-1 rocket aircraft, breaking the sound barrier for the first time. On October 14, 1962, an American U-2 spy plane took pictures proving that Soviet-made medium-range missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads were stationed on Cuba. The revelation brought the United States and the Soviet Union to the brink of nuclear war in what is called the Cuban Missile Crisis. In 1964, American black civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his nonviolent resistance to racial segregation in the United States. At the age of 35, King was the youngest person ever to receive the award. And on October 14, 2012, Felix Baumgartner jumped from the stratosphere, breaking the record of the highest free fall jump at an altitude of more than 39,000 meters. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In countries where the rule of law is weak or absent, respect for the human rights of individuals belonging to minority groups is often lacking. Although participating states of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, have committed to uphold the rule of law, in several of these countries, individuals from minority groups continue to be denied full human rights. Brian Atwood, head of the U.S. delegation to the OSCE's ongoing Human Dimension Implementation Meeting, or HDIM, in Warsaw, pointed out several examples. In Georgia, ethnic Georgians in the Russia-occupied regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia continue to be denied property rights and freedom of movement. Nationalist violence and ethnic cleansing that occurred in the Balkans during the 1990s continues to have a detrimental effect on the region. Some officials continue to deny serious wartime atrocities, including the genocide at Srebrenica in Bosnia. The U.S. urges officials and citizens in Bosnia, as well as the rest of the region, to continue working towards inter-ethnic reconciliation. In addition, Bosnia needs to implement the European Court of Human Rights decision in the Sejdić-Finci case to allow all citizens, regardless of ethnicity, to hold office and be represented in all state-level institutions. At HDIM, Atwood also raised Hungary's expansive nationality law, which may create cross-border and inter-ethnic tensions. The U.S. urges Hungary to ensure that its articulation of concerns for Hungarian minorities in countries such as Ukraine is both appropriate and constructive. Russia's actions in Ukraine present stark examples of both the denial of minority rights and the misappropriation of minority rights. Russia has violated the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine on the pretext of protecting ethnic Russians in Ukraine. In Russia-occupied Crimea, the religious, linguistic, and cultural rights of persons belonging to the Crimean Tatar community, as well as other religious and ethnic minorities, are under siege. The two most prominent community leaders, Mustafa Jemilyev and Refat Chubarov, are banned from returning to Crimea, their homeland, for 5 years. Ethnic minorities throughout the OSCE must be protected, and their rights must be respected.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.